So, is it cold enough for you? Are you looking forward to the blizzard tomorrow? We all talk about the weather, but how many of us really understand why it's raining or sunny or foggy? And how do meteorologists predict the weather? Well, with me now on today's Please Explain is Michael Schlachter, Chief Meteorologist for Weather 2000, Inc., a consulting firm, and by phone from California, Christopher Burt, an amateur meteorologist and author of the book Extreme Weather, a Guide and Record Book. I'm very pleased to welcome them both to the show, and we will be taking your calls later during this segment. So if you have a weather-related question, just give us a call at 212-433-9692. And let's begin with you, Michael. Is weather everything that's going on in the air and atmosphere around us? How would you define weather?
Weather is probably the combination of extremes that we deal with, and that's what we tend to pay attention to. But the atmosphere is a fluid, so we get all kinds of chaotic undulations. Sometimes it's normal, sometimes it's hot, sometimes it's cold. But we deal with all the temperature and precipitation and come up with forecasts.
Does the Earth's rotation affect the flow of weather?
Yes, it does. It creates what's known as a Coriolis effect, where as the Earth spins, it causes the masses of air to undulate around and move up and down between the equator and the Arctic. And what we call the borderline between these masses of air are what are called weather fronts. And they move from, west to east as a result of the spin of the Earth.
Well, I understand the west to east, and I've always wondered whether the weather just stayed where it was and the Earth just moved underneath it. But, and maybe you can clear that up, but why do hurricanes form off West Africa and move up across the Atlantic to the Caribbean? That's the opposite direction, isn't it?
That's right. That is the opposite direction. And that's because they're below the a certain latitude. They almost always form below 20 degrees latitude. And at that, around the equatorial regions, the weather isn't under so much of a flow because from the north isn't an influence so much from the spin from the north, and so they're able to wander slowly towards the west as they normally do during the hurricane season.
You have anything you want to add to that?
Well, essentially, the currents alternate as you go from the equator to the pole, so you tend to get weather systems progressing east to west down by the subtropics. In our weather patterns in North America, most of them are west to east. But then as you progress towards northern Canada, they once again reverse to east to west and back to west to east over near the poles. So it's a funny kind of combination. And where those things meet, you sometimes get some pretty interesting storms and fronts.
So northern hemisphere has weather patterns that are very different than the southern hemisphere?
Well, I would say the number one difference is the mass of ocean surface area in the southern hemisphere, which really affects the climate and the various weather systems. The interactions between land and water, which are much more numerous in the northern hemisphere, create perhaps a little bit more idiosyncratic and interesting weather events than down in South America, southern hemisphere.
Should we assume that the most basic concepts of weather are understood because I think we were all taught how rain forms in school, but are there things that we should know that we might have forgotten?
I would say that the most interesting aspect of contemporary meteorology and climatology is the role and impact that what we do as humans, the anthropogenic forcings and influences, have on our weather systems. It's very easy to deal with a vacuum or pressure or temperature when you're dealing with natural elements. But once you start throwing in pollution and various chlorofluorocarbons and various man-made elements, it really makes the whole atmospheric chemistry and dynamics much more complicated.
So is that why we might get a more misty rain in one part of the country and just a light drizzle in another? Is it because we have more particles in the air?
Well, the particles definitely help with forming precipitation in general, but I think one of the things that man-made influences do the most is to create idiosyncrasies within an urban area or within a 60-mile square area where you could have the heat and particulates from a city spurning thunderstorms, where perhaps in the suburban areas only 30 miles away, things are a little bit more calm. That could affect sea breezes. It can affect pollution being trapped in little suburban valleys. So atmospheric chemistry is probably the biggest area that has been burgeoning.
Will that affect whether we have a heavy rain or a light drizzle?
I would say so. Basically, the condensation nuclei that the particulates and the pollution produce can definitely affect raindrop size and also the acidic content of that rain, which is very big concern to farmers.
Christopher, what about electrical storms? We get them in the summer, not the winter. They usually come with rain, but not always with rain.
Well, they form at any time of the year, actually. They generally, they even occur occasionally in snowstorms. There's a chance that the snowstorm you're about to get, you might have some thunder and lightning accompanying it tomorrow night. When it moves to the region, the thunderstorms are really formed by intense circulation within the cloud, within clouds, and that creates a kind of static electricity that builds up between the Earth's surface and also within the clouds and between the Earth and the clouds. And the amount of precipitation that falls is in thunderstorms is not so much to do with the amount of electricity in the storm, but in the size of the clouds. Very large cumulonimbus clouds typically form violent thunderstorms, and you get both heavy rain and thunder and lightning from them.
But in some cases, the lightning looks very different than in others. We sometimes get those jaggedy lightning bolts. Other times, it's just pretty much a straight thing. I've heard that there's a difference between heat lightning and other kinds of lightning.
Well, there's actually technically no such thing as heat lightning. Heat lightning is just lightning that's visible at night when you can't hear the thunder or even see the clouds, that the storms that are producing the lightning. Lightning can be seen almost 50 miles away and further than you can even see or hear, of course, hear the thunder. So people see these flashes of light, often on a hot night, because that's when thunderstorms are more likely to occur, on hot evenings. And that's what heat lightning is. There are lots of different real types of lightning, though, not heat lightning. There's things called ribbon lightning, bead lightning. There's such a thing as super bolts, which are lightning bolts that are sometimes 100 times more powerful than an average lightning bolt.
And what determines the differences?
The differences are just various phenomena within the cloud. It's actually... Lightning is still a big research topic. There's also ball lightning, which has never been positively photographed, but is scientists are very curious about it because there's even a chance that it's some sort of form of natural cold fusion that forms. You know, the actual science of lightning is under constant investigation.
Now, my guests are Christopher Burt, who is the author of a book called Extreme Weather, a Guide and Record Book, and Michael Schlechter, who's chief meteorologist for Weather 2000 Incorporated, a consulting firm. And we're talking about lightning on Please. I'm not lightning on, weather on Please Explain. Michael, I have a lot of trouble reading some of those weather maps. I have no understanding of the isobars and the other symbols, and I know a lot of it has to do with barometric pressure.
One of the best ways for people to visualize a weather map is almost a topographical map paradigm, where you almost look at the contours as various levels of terrain, because the wind tends to flow from higher pressure to lower pressure. So when you see those contours and the cyclonic anticyclonic clockwise motion around high pressures, they tend to then flow counterclockwise and cyclonic into low pressures. And it goes back to my analogy of the atmosphere being a fluid. And then, as was mentioned before, the boundary of these different air masses, either separating wet from dry or warm from cold, are depicted by fronts that we see as lines marching across the U.S.
Well, how do we even wind up with high pressure and low pressure?
Well, basically, the atmosphere is very dynamic, so you get colder air that's a little bit more dense, and that can create a thickness that's represented in terms of the pressure. And you get warmer molecules that are more active, and that will be less dense air. And various things can affect the pressure. The Earth and our hemispheric atmosphere is constantly trying to reach equilibrium.
Why are tornadoes a bigger problem in Oklahoma than in New York City? Don't they have high and low pressure just like we do?
Well, tumultuous weather events such as severe thunderstorms, some of which do produce tornadoes, are basically fueled by these unequal pressures and unequal temperatures. So the bigger the contrast you have and the more clashes you have, warm versus cold, wet versus dry, the more tumultuous these storms become. And Tornado Alley is a wonderful basically clashing point that is very unique actually throughout the entire planet, where you get moist air coming in from the Gulf of Mexico, dry air coming in from Mexico, and cooler air coming down from Canada. Tornadoes are actually a very confined North American phenomenon, and that particular area in the U.S. is quite unique for that.
So you're really, it's a clash between high and low pressures and hot and wet and dry.
Exactly, but mostly the differences between temperature and moisture content.
And also, I might add that you know, the United North America is unique on Earth in terms of the fact that such a large land mass, where there are no natural barriers, mountains separating the Arctic air from the subtropical and tropical air, so they're able to meet over the high plains in the Midwest, and this is one of the main reasons that tornadoes are so much more common there than any other place in the world.
Let's take a call from Tim from Queens. Hi, you're on the Leonard Lopate Show.
Hi.
Yes, Tim.
My question is, how do you define a front? And I don't mean the term, but I mean the actual thing. I mean, we all know that there are the pressure gradients, but when does the gradient become steep enough so that it becomes a front by the weatherman's definition or the meteorologist's definition?
You want to take that, Mike? Chris?
I'm not sure I got the question. How do you define a front?
Yes, a weather front, physically speaking.
Physically speaking, it's the border between two different masses of air.
And what happens when those two masses of air hit? One pushes the other?
Yes, that's right. One pushes into the other, and depending on what types of mass of air, it depends upon what kind of weather you're going to have associated with that front.
Also, the caller should know that it is somewhat subjective. Meteorologists basically will work with what's given to them, and that's usually observations at weather stations and maps. And then we will decide, is there a big enough contrast between the two different temperature masses and the moisture fields to create a front? And sometimes there's debate. Sometimes one meteorologist will say, I think there should be a front here. Mm-hmm. Other times they'll say it's not enough defined. So it is very subjective.
Yeah. Michael from New Jersey, I think you want to further this discussion.
Absolutely. The same thing as a front. What exactly is a trough? If I think of a trough, they always say it's a high pressure. The high pressure is colder air. Colder air tends to be more dense. Does that mean that the trough is somewhat a dimple or a depression in the atmosphere, in the troposphere? I've never been able to visualize that. Or is a trough something else? I'm not really quite sure.
Sure. A trough is basically a subset of a front. And it's usually a minor frontal boundary, and we tend to depict troughs more in the mid to upper troposphere. And I think your analogy is great, that when you analyze pressure fields, it is kind of a dimple, and that's why I was saying the topographical analogy is really good here. So this could be a little plateau or valley within the overall ridge that could cut across. So we often see little troughs bring light precipitation or cloud events, whereas the true cold and warm fronts will be more distinctive.
Thank you for your call. I wonder about, and many New Yorkers wonder, why this winter has been so mild until recently. It's felt strange to have 60-degree weather in January, and yet in Europe, they have been going through one of the worst cold snaps in history. Are there any links between the two?
Yes, basically the cold air that's been pent up and building up in the Arctic regions can either be locked up there permanently or it can kind of break the dam, so to speak. And in December, believe it or not, I know people kind of forgot about winter, but we had a pretty phenomenal first 3 weeks in North America with a lot of that cold air pouring into Europe as well as us. Then it seemed to kind of just flow into Europe and Russia. But we very well might get this back. The way the patterns are looking, February and March might bring us a return to winter weather.
So, Chris, does weather in one place affect the weather 1,000 or 10,000 miles away? Does weather in one place affect the weather 1,000 miles or 10,000 miles
yes,
away?
Yes, it's all connected. The Michael's analogy of, you know, it being a fluid atmosphere is very true. And when you, make a splash in one part of the tub, it has ripple effect all across the rest of the tub. And the Earth's atmosphere is very much like that. It's all interconnected.
Well, for many people, the first thing they thought of was global warming. And when we come back after we take a little break, we'll find out whether global warming might be affecting the way our weather is. Some people are suggesting that we are entering a new weather era. My guests on Please Explain today, Please Explain on Weather, are Michael Schlachter, Chief Meteorologist for Weather 2000, Inc., which is a consulting firm, and Christopher Bird, who's an amateur meteorologist and the author of the book Extreme Weather, a Guide and Record Book. Stay with us. And we're back with Please Explain, talking about weather. My guests are Christopher Burt, who is the author of Extreme Weather, a Guide and Record Book, and Michael Schlachter, who's the Chief Meteorologist for Weather 2000 Incorporated, a weather consulting firm. And before we go to your calls, which, by the way, should be made at 212-433-9692, that's the call-in number if you want to go on the air and talk about weather on today's Please Explain. Before we get to that, I would like to spend a little time on global warming. Are we seeing the effects of it, do you think, Michael?
Absolutely. There should be no debate whatsoever as to the topic of global warming. What is being debated amongst
But it is in our government to this day.
Well, I think where politicians and scientists as well are debating the topic is the magnitude of warming and to what extent humans and industry are responsible and what can be attributed to natural causes. But the actual Earth temperature rising is an undebatable topic.
And do you think that it has led, as some people suggest, to things like the heavy hurricane season that we experienced this past fall?
Yes and no. We have to be very careful for people who are passionate about the global warming topic from attributing everything we see in terms of extreme weather to the global warming subject. The prevailing consensus among scientists is that global warming probably squeezed out a few more storms, maybe squeezed out a little bit more intensity, but that the hurricanes that we see decades down the road will probably have the largest influence as a result of global warming.
Well, Christopher, if the oceans are warmer, doesn't that increase the intensity of a hurricane or a typhoon? I never understood the difference between a hurricane and a typhoon. Maybe you can explain that as well.
Well, there is no difference between a hurricane and typhoon except their nomenclature. It's just a typhoon is a hurricane that forms in the West Pacific, west of the international dateline. And a hurricane, in fact, hurricanes can form in the East Pacific, cross the dateline, and become typhoons, even though it's the same storm. It's just the names that are used. And around Australia and in the Indian Ocean, they're called cyclones. And they have both typhoons and cyclones have a different intensity scale system than the ones we use in the Atlantic. You know, we have our five one through five scale system, category one through five. And it's different in the Pacific and different in the Indian Ocean as well. Actually, the storms in the Pacific tend to be more typhoons, more tropical storms form in the Pacific than anywhere else in the any other body of water. And they also tend to be considerably more powerful than Atlantic storms do. For instance, Wilma, which was the most powerful, the deepest barometric pressure. We use the barometric pressure at the center of the storm to determine its strength. Wilma was the most powerful ever recorded in the Atlantic basin, actually anywhere in the Western Hemisphere. And yet there have been 16 Pacific typhoons that in just the last 50 years that were stronger than Wilma.
Any idea why?
Yes, because of the size of the Pacific.
Oh, it's just a larger ocean.
The body of water has more fuel. It's warmer. It gets back to your question about sea surface temperature. There's a much larger pool of much warmer water in the Pacific than there is in the Atlantic. And this is why the storms both are more frequent and stronger in the Pacific. That being said, this past season was interesting because some of the highest sea surface temperatures ever measured occurred both along the Atlantic coastline and in the Gulf of Mexico. Off the coast of New Jersey, a buoy reached 84 degrees far off, not on the shoreline, but off in near the Gulf Stream area off New Jersey. That was the warmest at that latitude ever recorded at that particular station at that location. In the Gulf of Mexico, the sea surface temperature prior to Katrina striking the Louisiana-Mississippi coastline, there were some buoy temperatures of over 90 degrees sea surface temperature, which again was almost unprecedented.
Let's go to some of our calls. Beth from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the Leonard Lopate Show.
Hi, wonderful topic. A fast question: when the tsunami happened a little over a year ago, I remember reading in Newsweek that it was so powerful it altered the Earth's axis, and that's going to affect magnetic fields and all that stuff. Do we yet have a sense of how that's going to play out in weather?
Michael?
Well, the first thing we have to do is separate the subjects of seismology, which include plate tectonics and volcanology and whatnot, from the atmosphere. Yes, the tsunami was so large and had such a, reverberating momentum effect throughout our planet that there is some discussion that it kind of caused a little bit of a wobble, obviously far less detectable than anything humans can pick up. I personally don't think this far out from it's going to have any implications of significance to our magnetosphere or the weather consequently.
Thank you for your call, Beth. Craig from New York. Hi, you're on. Please explain.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I was always curious how much faith television viewers should have on the local weathermen's forecast when they go, 5 days out. And even the Weather Channel website, they even go 10 days out, and you're making plans for the weekend. And then by Thursday, you got to rethink what you're doing if you're doing something outdoors. And I was just curious, should they be viewed more as a snapshot in time, or is there really something to it if those forecasts are more than just pretty graphics? And I'll hang up.
Okay, thank you for your call. I'm sure both of you want to respond to that. Michael, you want to start, and then Chris?
Sure. The first thing we have to do is make sure that the person who is delivering the information is, in fact, a true scientist. No offense to a lot of the broadcasters out there, but a lot of them have communications backgrounds and perhaps don't necessarily have all the meteorological tools and information at their service. But presuming that it's a true degreed meteorologist, we have to set little bounds out for forecast accuracy. At Weather 2000, we don't really buy into daily forecasts beyond a week or 10 days, and we don't buy into weekly forecasts beyond a month, and we don't buy into seasonal forecasts beyond a year. So if you hear someone trying to tell you today about your Memorial Day weekend plans, that's obviously a little silly, but computer models have helped predict storms and weather events with far more accuracy than was available 20, 30 years ago, even 5, 10 years ago. But depending on how complex the event is, the shorter your horizon should be. So if you're worrying about temperatures 7 days down the road in San Diego, you probably could put some faith in that. But there's still some uncertainty, for example, just 24 hours from now regarding the potential big coastal snowstorm hitting the corridor of Philadelphia to Boston.
We don't. Often we get a weather report saying it's going to be a terrible storm. It turns out to be a wimpy little thing. Christopher, what do you want to add to that?
Well, that's because with a storm, for instance, the one that's heading your direction now, just a slightest difference in the track can make a huge difference to, you know, whether it's snow or rain in Manhattan or snow or rain in Sussex County in New Jersey. You know, 20 miles could be the difference between 1 foot of snow and 1 inch of snow as far as the track of the storm is. And so it's very difficult for forecasters to really pinpoint the exact track. Of course, this is even more critical when forecasting hurricane paths. As we know, there was a lot of criticism in Florida about Hurricane Charley in August of 2004 when they predicted it was going to hit Tampa, and it swerved at the last moment into Fort Myers instead. And, you know, that I'm sure in the insurance industry it was upset about that, or maybe not so upset because there would have been more damage if it had hit Tampa. But it's very hard to forecast exactly. Out here in the West Coast, where because of the topography, we have, you know, these microclimates, and the difference in the weather at my home in the hills in Oakland is very different than a location through the Caldecott Tunnel, which is, you know, 1,000 yards long. On the other end of the tunnel, it can be 20 degrees warmer than it is at my house here.
In fact, in San Francisco, there are areas that are 10, 15 degrees warmer than others in the same city.
Well, more like 40 degrees.
Oh, really? Wow.
Some days.
Usually colder.
It can be 59 on the coast up to Ocean Beach in San Francisco and be 100 degrees in Orinda, which is only 15 miles away as the crow flies.
Well, what about the – well, you're in risk management, aren't you? Weather risk management?
Absolutely.
Michael? What does that mean?
Well, basically, people, but more so corporations and industry, will want to plan and prepare for the weather. Sometimes it's preparing and planning for small or major short-term events such as hurricanes or thunderstorms. In other circumstances, it's preparing for seasonal weather. How warm or cold will the winter be? How volatile will it be? How dry or wet will the summer be? And we help them out with that.
My guests are Michael Schechter of Weather 2000 Incorporated and Christopher Burt, author of Extreme Weather, a guide and record book. Well, in the old days, people used to rely on other ways of predicting the weather. Red sky at night, sailors delight, red sky at morn, sailors take warn. How accurate are some of these things? I mean, I'm thinking about some others. When ants travel in a straight line, expect rain. When they scatter, expect fair weather. Flies bite more before rain. Bees will not swarm before a storm. When squirrels lay in a big store of eggs, look for a hard winter. Do any of those turn out to be true?
I would say yes, but you have to set your time frame perhaps only out 12, 24, 36 hours. I think people who study animal behavior, including insects, can get a wonderful plethora of information. And farmers have been doing this for eons. And you can really get a feel for tried and true rules of thumb.
A farmer might notice that a cow with its tail to the west makes weather the best. A cow with its tail to the east makes weather the least.
And pilots knew that, too. Pilots would look at the position of cows in World War II to find out where to land, in what direction.
Really? So cows are great weather predictors.
At least wind direction.
Well, you know, I think that they could save a lot of money on television, get rid of Al Roker, and just bring in a cow. Should we take some more calls? Our number here is 212-433-9692. Andre from Manhattan. Hi, you're on. Please explain.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a fairly simple question. I follow weather every day. I read weather maps. I know what a cold front is. I know what a warm front is. But there's one mystery that I've never been able to solve completely. What is an occluded front? What does it do, and why is it called occluded?
Christopher?
Well, an occluded front is a front that's basically neither a warm or a cold front. It's not necessarily separating temperature difference from one side or the other. What it is it's also sometimes known as a stationary front. But an occluded front is when, oh boy, that's a tough one to explain without having a paper and pencil, and it's easier to so how to explain it than explain it in words. It's basically where a cold and a warm front have melded at a certain point along the storm system path, and it's no longer separating two different types of air. That it might be separating a wind direction from one side of the front or the other. And it's along, getting back to that trough, an occluded front will usually be following the bottom of a low-pressure trough as well.
Thank you for your call, Andre. And we go now to John from Glen Cove.
Yes, hi. I have a question about the sort of bigger picture of the weather and global warming. It seems to me that what we've been seeing lately and what sort of muddies the discussion about whether or not it's global warming is that, well, yes, we've been having very cold winters and violent blizzards and so on. And I've always wondered that if the hurricanes are getting stronger, if the droughts are getting longer, if the floods are getting more widespread, if the colds are cold and the hots are hotter, colds are colder and the hots are hotter, is there an analogy such as that when you boil a pot of water, you get little bubbles at first, like ginger ale, but then when you keep adding heat to it, you get a rolling boil. That is to say, the bubbles get bigger. So would it be the case that we are seeing more intense cold air masses meeting more intense warm air masses as the bubbles get bigger because the heat engine is driving a more violent system so that we get more violent confrontations at the warm fronts, cold fronts, etc.?
Michael Schlachter?
Sure, that's a very good question. Global warming, although it's quite real, may not be all-encompassing as, let's say, a term such as global climate change, which we really refer to. And climate is essentially the average of extreme events, and there's no doubt about it that the Earth goes through both natural and unnatural cycles that could either mitigate extremities or increase them. And what we're trying to resolve as scientists is to what extent humans might be accelerating that process. We often give the analogy of humans consuming alcohol. If you can consume it at a moderate, slow pace, the Earth has a wonderful tolerance, just like we do. But if you drink too much too fast, your body will regurgitate and reject it. And we think that the Earth might be kind of rejecting a lot of these pollutants that we're putting into it. And as a result, the way the Earth, quote unquote, gets sick is by spurning off these violent weather extremes and frequent storms.
Along those lines, Mike from Newark, New Jersey.
Yes. Hello. What about the theory that I've come across a couple times that the pollutants are actually reflecting the sun's rays and heat away from the planet and thereby keeping it cooler?
Christopher?
I'm not an atmospheric scientist. I've heard this before, but maybe Michael would be more qualified to answer.
Michael, do you know?
Well, I think that question just exemplifies how complex this topic is, because the recipe that goes into the global warming predictions and observations are really a hodgepodge of things that increase the warming as well as detract from it. And what you're referring to in particular are the sulfates, which could lead to some cooling. And also, if we have increased cloud cover, that's going to increase the albedo of the troposphere, and a lot of that sun won't get in. So you kind of have to add up the plus column and the minus column and find out your budget, and that budget has been a net global warming rising.
Now, people over the years have tried to control the weather. Some Native American cultures have developed complicated rituals to affect it. And I remember going back to my childhood, people trying to seed clouds to create rain. Most recently, I heard China try to do something like that in order to ease drought conditions. Does it ever work?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt that weather modification or that humans can control some form of weather. But the problem is, can you control it and produce weather in a direction that you want and with a consistent confidence that you want? And that's really backfired.
And don't you need clouds before you can seed them? So if it's a cloudless sky, you could be praying for rain all you want, but you can't seed them.
That's a big part of it. And I think really the moral of the story is that we should kind of stay out of the realm of Mother Nature, focus on understanding our atmosphere, predicting it better, but not trying to modify it.
Well, talking about predicting, Nancy from Middletown, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
There have been a number of very scientific, technical questions. I'm impressed with how much everybody has really understood the weather. But I have a question for you that's a little off the board here. Is what is it about this time of year that gives any kind of validity to poor old Punxsutawney Phil and the groundhog in the way of trying to predict the weather? Is there anything religious or historical about this time of year that people think that can happen?
The folklore between the Punxsutawney Bill, I think it's kind of an arbitrary date as far as I know, and
it's probably also better to look at cows' tails.
I don't think his track record is really that good. I think it's more of a town event than an actual people taking it seriously as a forecasting tool.
Well, actually, I'm born on Groundhog's Day, so I take it very seriously.
And what happened? Was it a good winter that followed or a bad one?
Did you see your shadow?
Yes, absolutely. And we are definitely having six more weeks of the kind of winter we've had, which has been erratic. But see, the groundhog has a built-in hedge in that the phrase is six more weeks of winter or spring is right around the corner. But how far out is that corner?
Yeah. Half a dozen of one, six of the other, right?
Bingo.
And we thank you so much for your call, Nancy, and we thank all of you so much for calling, and a special thanks to our guest, Christopher Burt, author of Extreme Weather, a Guide and Record Book, and Michael Schlachter, Chief Meteorologist for Weather 2000 Incorporated, which is a consulting firm. It's been not only a lot of fun, but I think I understand weather a little better, although I'm still not sure about fog. We'll get to that another time.
Looking forward to it.